Accession number 34702, Reel 10.
Hey, down in Reel 10. So, Eric, you mentioned that you were planning your sortie for war, but is this part of the classification system where you become combat ready?
Well, no, you're already classified as combat ready before this, otherwise you wouldn't be involved. But this was planning what to do on the targets that you would be attacking in the event of the balloon going up.
So were you initially given a specific target for you, for your crew, your aircraft?
Yes, we were. And we'd go into the room and the navigator would plot his course and all the rest of it, and we would make notes of where the information given to us about anti-aircraft or fighter aircraft stations or interceptions, that sort of thing. And the IP would be chosen and the target would be chosen and everything would be planned to carry out that attack.
Would you ever carry out a sort of mock attack in that direction?
No, not... the RBS attacks that we're doing in this country, practice, was exactly the same setup.
And I take it there was a quite a large degree of secrecy as to what your target was and what you
were supposed to do. We had to go and draw out the nav bag with all the information in and whatnot and sign for it, and then we were locked into a room for an hour or so. And we had to do so many hours a month on this type of work.
And what would have been the plan then? What would the planning that you were doing, what would that have entailed? What would you have put together as a package? And what would you have, what was it proposed that you would carry out?
Well, the route would be all laid out, and the recovery, if any. Sometimes it was back to the UK, sometimes it was down to Cyprus. But we weren't under any illusions, really. I mean, if an all-out nuclear war broke out, I mean, we probably wouldn't get back anyway. And if we did, what would we come back to anyway? It was apocalypse, really, wasn't it? So it was all based on the deterrent effect, of course.
And would this be done at high level at that time?
Yes, this was high level this time. Yes, it was all high level then, yes. Up in the 40,000 feet area, yes. And we had procedures for, once we released the bomb, turning away rapidly, and we had shields that come down to shield against the light. And that was that. I'm not sure at that time, but certainly later on we had two sets of targets. One for if we went alone, Britain went alone to war, or another set in conjunction with the Americans if it was a NATO affair.
And what were your aircraft painted at that time?
White. They were white. Anti, supposed to reflect the glare, etc.
And you would have a procedure, would you, for at the point, as you said, where you drop the bomb for recovery?
Yeah.
How close would you be to the target, roughly, when you'd have dropped your bomb?
Well, the time it takes for it to get there from 40,000 feet, I can't really recollect. That was always a matter of minutes, I suppose.
Did you ever participate at that stage in sort of exercises, I'm thinking, because it was quite a period of heightened tension, wasn't it, at that point? I'm thinking where you might be, sitting on the airfield waiting to take off.
This is the early days and we're building up to all this sort of thing. but we'd have exercises, and we would disperse. We had dispersal airfields where, say, three aircraft would go to another airfield, which had a special setup there, accommodation, cooking arrangements, all the rest of it. And we'd fly off from base, land there, something like a Beverly or a Hastings or Comet or something would bring the ground crew and all the rest of it up there, and you would be there for a week or so. Well, and in that time, we'd have several alerts, and there were various stages of alert, and sometimes you stood down for a while, other times you got to the aircraft and actually started the engines, and sometimes actually took off. This was all done by the bomber controller over radio, and one of the features of if we actually went was that we had a fail-safe thing on the BBC light programme that we had to, if we didn't receive a code word on that light programme, we would turn back, come back to base. So in other words, a fail-safe system. You wouldn't have a rogue aircraft going off on its own and dropping an atomic bomb somewhere.
Were you armed at that stage with atomic weapons?
We did have them then, yes. And they were loaded onto the aircraft at times, yes. But they weren't, were never brought up to the armed stage. And it took two of us in the aircraft to be able to do that and release it anyway.
So it was just single individual.
It's just a matter of carrying the thing, yes.
So were you a sort of a, you were, I imagine that throughout that period then you were at quite a state of preparedness, were you, for that, you know, that you well, could be called upon at any time?
Well, yes, an exercise could be called on any time, and was, yes. Sometimes in the middle of the night, the sirens go off and a vehicle go around the married quarters and blaring out, and we tumble out of bed and go into and see what was happening. It was usually an exercise of being called, yes. Later on, when we were on the Mark IIs, that was when QRA came in, the Quick Reaction Alert, where crews were in flying kit all day, housed in the ops block, amusing themselves and doing some of this planning. And they were there for 24 hours, and we slept in a caravan round the back, and there were vehicles outside the ops room, one for each crew, which was plugged into the electrics to keep the engine warm. So hopefully when you went out to start, the car would start up, and you'd drive out to dispersal then, jump in the aircraft, which had been combat ready, and then taxi out. And then later on, of course, they had ORPs, which were the Operational Readiness Platform, which was built onto the side of the runway at the takeoff point, so the aircraft were actually there. And they brought in what was called a SIM start, where you could press one button and all four engines started at the same time, and all the lights went out locally. not theoretically, not in actual practice now, but it took that sort of amount of power to.
So how quickly could you get off the ground then? In a
couple of minutes, yeah, if you were out there, yes.
So that would be very rapid.
But you've done all the checks.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of starting the engines and straight on the runway and off.
So how long were you with 101 then? Were you?
So I was with 101 till 1961. And then the Mark II Vulcan was coming in to service. And my crew was one of the ones selected to go to Waddington and convert onto the Mark II.
What were the differences between it? I mean, you've mentioned obviously the question with the electrics and the engines.
Bigger engines, greater power, longer range, more fuel, more of everything, in other words. Later ECM equipment, electronic countermeasures, that sort of thing. And this new AC electrical system as well, which was introduced.
So for you as a pilot, I take it was relatively similar, was it?
Yes.
To the Mark 1. A lot of the stuff that had come in was stuff that improves the aircraft
rather than
how it handles.
Yes.
And was that a 230 operational conversion unit?
That's 230 OCU again, yes. And we were going to be part of 27 Squadron, which was going to reform at Scampton, along with 617 there, and 83 that had been at Waddington was also going to move to Scampton, so the Mark II wing, if you like, would have all be at Scampton then.
And I take it with the conversion to this is, it takes less time for you, does it, really?
Well, I see we spent quite a lot of time in the flight simulator first, getting used to the new, I think it was the Smith flight system, which was new as well, which we're getting used to, as well as the electrical system and various other changes.
So was the simulator then really, was it aimed at exercises for those different, those new changes that run into the Mark II, really?
Yes, or, I mean, obviously, it had to cater for people who hadn't come off the Mark I later on, straight onto the Mark II, because as the Mark IIs came in, the Mark Is was withdrawn and had the electrical systems replaced and brought up to date in other ways, and became Mark 1As. And the three squadrons of Mark 1As formed and up at Waddington. And they carried on as the Mark 1A Vulcan. So people coming through the OCU could be coming straight onto the Mark 2, not having experienced anything in the Mark 1, of course. Completely new to it. As the squadrons increased in number,
I'm assuming then that there was an advantage, obviously, for you and your crew, though, whether because you had flown the Mark 1 beforehand, then, as opposed to some crew.
Oh, yes, we did quite a lot of simulator stuff initially, and then didn't do very much flying. A couple of trips and then solo trip and a night duel and night circuits. And then a final handling test at the end. So it didn't take all that long, from March to April, and we'd finished the course.
And was it then on to 27?
Then I went to 27 Squadron in May 1961.
Am I right in thinking at this time you picked up the one of the Vulcans that's on display at Duxford?
Yes,
at the moment.
Yes,
is that one of the new Mark IIs coming into service?
This was May 15th, 1961. XJ824, self and crew delivery from Woodford to Scampton. And in those days, we still... each crew had its own aircraft, in effect. It didn't last for long, this, because it wasn't very flexible, obviously. And it might be under all the layers of paint. My name's still on the door. I don't know if it's got the same door. And we had a crew chief allocated as well, so we had a complete crew. But later on, well, even then, all my trips weren't in 824, but because of availability and servicing and one thing and another.
Is there a servicing rotor to the aircraft then that usually exists?
Yes. Oh yes, there's on hours and landing and things like that. We had to pass a test and got a certificate somewhere on all the aircraft. It happened on the cameras as well, where we were qualified to do the pre-flight and after-flight checks ourselves for when we were away from base. Even though I got the crew chief there, the thing like the parachute to pack up and put away and all that sort of thing. And
so what other parts of the test would you have to do really with the aircraft when you were... Would you take a walk around it and check?
Oh yes, you had a pre-flight check to do, which you walked around it, checked the wheels, the tyres, checked for any oil leaks, checked all the control locks were out and the engine blanks. You don't want to be taking off with an engine blank. I mean, it has been known for aircraft to take off with the pitot head cover on and then have no airspeed, of course. So you had to check all those sort of things. And anything obvious, and then quite extensive checks when you got on board from a checklist which you had to go through meticulously. And then all this, if it went for combat ready situations, you'd do all this would be done beforehand and the aircraft left ready then just to start the engines. You'd have a crew chief outside who would be connected on the intercom. And you tell him what state you're at and when you're going to start the engines and that sort of thing.
So you would do all of that. And again, would that be the same once you actually landed the aircraft? Would you do a sort of after, you said an after check, would that be the same sort of thing?
Not normally, no. After landing we would depart. But if we were away from base, then we'd have a after check round and put the aircraft to bed, as it were, with help of the crew chief. Put the engine blanks in and pitot head covers on and bits and pieces like that. Collect up the old parachute and pack it up and stow it away in the pannier in the bomb bay. Fit the new parachute in, ready for the next trip. That sort of thing. This didn't happen later on with the Mark IIs because they had a new type of material for the brake pads which was much more effective, and we didn't normally stream the chute on every landing. Only if we thought it was going to be a short runway or no wind or any extenuating circumstances.
Would that happen a lot at some of the places you had to use away from base, really?
Not normally, because all the American bases all had long runways. Most of the places we went overseas were international airports or Air Force bases which had reasonably long runways. So we would try not to stream the chute, obviously, because it involves us in a lot of work packing it up and putting it away. So
it was on to Scampton, was it?
That's the Scampton, yes. 27th Squadron, yes. Things were sort of more organised by this time. We were going into this QRA thing that I mentioned. Exercises were popping up all over the place, and real emergencies like the Cuban crisis.
What happened at that stage, then?
All came to combat ready, as it were. We went to briefing and allocated aircraft and etc. etc. Something peculiar went on at the top. The station commander was Peter Willie Helmore. He was quite an eccentric sort of character. And what had went on exactly, we don't know, but he disappeared from the scene, was kept in his room in the mess, and the Wing Commander Flying took over the station. This never came out, of course. but what exactly happened, I don't know.
Was it some form of breakdown, do you think?
I think so, because... After that, I think he was Eratashi at Saigon, and he used to go sailing a lot, and one day he went sailing and never came back and disappeared.
So was that a lot to do, you think, with the sort of situation at that
been,
time,
yes,
and the pressure?
It might have been too much, I don't know. Because it did, as you probably know, it did get very close.
And were you deployed at that stage?
We weren't deployed, no. We were still held at readiness at Scampton. We hadn't. It wasn't a case of us being attacked, so we didn't disperse. So everybody was at readiness to go from Scampton if it was deemed necessary.
And what were people generally thinking at that time? Did they think it was that the situation was close to potential nuclear war?
Well, I think so, yes. Some, you know, it was very close, in fact, wasn't it? And Kennedy called Khrushchev his bluff, and that was it.
But at that time, did you think there was a real potential that you might actually be involved?
Yes, yes. Oh, yes, yes.
Was that at the same time as they brought in the quick reaction force, or was that the was it roughly at that period of time?
Yes, I think we'd had QRA in at that time as well, yes. I think it was, just trying to remember what year it was that, the Cuban thing. We've got nothing in the logbook, of course, because we didn't do anything. But,
I think it was 62.
62, was it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. No, it all quietened down again after that. And
is that into the round of the same sort of stuff? Exercise? Exercise? You know, the exercises?
That's right. Yeah. Exercise Spellbound, I see there. And fighter affiliation. Group exercises, Group X. In between trips to America for various reasons. One more noteworthy, when I was selected to take the Air Vice Marshal Dunn, who was the AOC One Group. He was going on a trip around the America to the SAC bases for liaison purposes, and he did a quick course at Finningley and then used to come to us, and we'd go up and fly around and do the usual stuff, single length, three engine approaches and landings and takeoffs and etc. And then we went off on this trip. Went to Goose Bay in Offutt, and from Offutt to Vandenberg Air Force Base, was where they were going to test fire a Thor missile. That time, part of Bomber Command was equipped with the Thor missile, and every so often, a crew from this country would go over there with a Thor for real firing, just to prove it worked. And we were taken to this observation point about a quarter of a mile away, I suppose, from the site. And the countdown that was all being relayed to us over the Tannoy system, which was all going very nicely, until they said lift off, and they said next thing was take cover, and nobody did, but the missile came off the ground, went sideways and blew up. And I thought about this recently when this Trident missile thing was being mentioned in the papers. And I couldn't understand why all the fuss about this Trident missile, quite honestly, because the idea of firing things is to find out if it can go wrong. And I mean, the safety procedures are such that it would never go anywhere near the target anyway. It would be destroyed before it got got anywhere, and that's what happened here. It wasn't working properly, so they destroyed it. So that was quite interesting. And we went round quite a few of the bases, Castle Air Force Base, off at, back to Goose Bay, and then back home again. There were one or two sort of amusing incidents, really. We were... I did all the flight planning and all that sort of thing. The crew, the air marshal just came and got in the seat and took off, of course. And their flight planning documents, they had to list all the crew, whether it was a two-star or three-star general or whatnot, and the names and all the rest of it, and the serial numbers. And like a fool, I said to the air marshal, "What's your serial number?" He said, "Eric, there's so few of us, we know each other by name. We don't have a serial number." And on another occasion, we're usually entertained to luncheon in the officers' club. And the commanding officer there stood on his feet, said a welcome speech, and I said, "We welcome Marshal Dunn, who will now give a short address." So Paddy Dunn got up and said, "Number one group, Royal Air Force Bawtry, Yorkshire, England," and sat down. Much to the surprise of the assembled throng. So he did have a sense of humour.